David Garland, a professor of law and sociology at NYU, argues that although it's constantly written about and fiercely debated, capital punishment remains little understood. At present, the United States is the only Western country that has not abolished the death penalty. Professor Garland's latest book, Peculiar Institution, examines the history, sociology, and significance of the practice. The book is published by Harvard Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings David Garland to our show today. Hello.
Thank you.
Most case studies that we read about regarding the death penalty involve miscarriages of justice, wrongful convictions, and the irreversibility of the punishment. But your first chapter makes a different kind of case. You've called it the exemplary execution. Can you describe the case and tell us why you started there?
Well, the opening chapter of the book actually describes how even in the very worst kind of cases, even when a serial killer who's confessed his guilt, who's been found guilty after a proper trial and decent defense, when it comes time to execute him many, many years later, it turns out that there's still issues surrounding the case. There's still questions as to whether or not he was properly assessed in terms of his mental health, in terms of whether the prosecution disclosed all the evidence. Eventually, it turns out that even the very worst kind of case, the death penalty can't deal with in a singularly effective way. So the case is there to show that even in the kind of poster child for the death penalty, it doesn't seem to work the way we want it to.
Well, who would be the ideal candidate for capital punishment? Somebody who doesn't, who has an average IQ, who doesn't have any mental problems, has not been abused as a child. How far do we go along these lines?
For proponents who care to make the death penalty targeted on the very worst of the worst offenses, these are the kinds of defendants that they have in mind. The problem is that, as Justice Stevens recently observed, that even that kind of targeted death penalty over the last 40 years hasn't been effectively delivered.
Now, I'm glad you brought up Justice Stevens because you made the front page of the New York Times in connection to him. He said reading your book actually forced him to rethink some of his positions.
Justice Stevens is the last surviving member of the court from 1976 in the case of Gregg versus Georgia, which basically reintroduced the death penalty, which basically allowed new statutes that had been passed at that time to go ahead on the basis that they could be procedurally correct, safeguarded, and deliver the death penalty to the worst of the worst without any discrimination or arbitrariness. What Justice Stevens, I think, has learned over the last 34 years is that in this country, when you allow local prosecutors and local juries to decide who the worst of the worst are, it's a very politicized process and often a very racist one.
And he also said that he assumed the courts would hold the death penalty to a higher standard than they have.
He was very upset, and many people were, that the court allowed, for example, victim impact statements to be presented to juries who are deciding about the death worthiness of defendants. He was concerned about the politics of prosecution and state-elected judges and so on. He basically believed that after 30-odd years of an effort to do so, the American death penalty couldn't be reliably delivered.
Historically, haven't all nations imposed a death penalty at one time or another? All cultures.
This is the remarkable thing. 300 years ago, capital punishment was a kind of cultural universal. Every organized society used it. It was regarded as relatively unproblematic for a whole host of crimes and offenses. Over the last 250 years, all the Western nations, with a singular exception of the USA, have moved to abolish the death penalty. And even the USA is on that track. It's actually narrowed and restrained it to a very tiny institution that still exists.
Well, they also used to be public, and then they became secret, and then, as you say, in most countries, eliminated totally. But how much of this has to do with creating the legitimacy of the state?
Right. The early days of the death penalty, or at least the early days of the modern state, were when the death penalty was used most spectacularly, publicly and intensively. When we think about the very worst scaffold punishments, hanging and drawing and quartering, these were the days when state authorities were desperately seeking to impose their monopoly of legitimate violence and to show they were in charge. Once states became established and legitimate, once they had police forces and prisons and social policies, the death penalty became so violent and so egregiously illiberal that it began to be hidden and restrained and restricted.
But it wasn't less than 100 years ago. There were public hangings in this country, and they often were picnics, barbecues, a time of kind of public celebration.
You know, that's completely true. This nation is actually many different places as far as the death penalty is concerned. The northern states abolished public executions in the 1830s. Some of the southern states didn't get around to doing it for 100 years later in the 1930s.
And then there were lynchings that were not legitimate capital punishment, but they still were people punishing other people for alleged offenses.
The most spectacular lynching has occurred in the southern states at the turn of the 20th century. And they occurred when local popular mobs and crowds believed that the criminal justice system, the official state system, wasn't punitive and spectacular enough to deal with the offenders that they really hated. And lynchings were a way of, as it were, imposing popular justice in a spectacle of retribution.
Weren't they usually in more rural areas? Was there a feeling that justice just took too long?
They were sometimes rural areas, sometimes towns, sometimes even cities. And the sense was that justice could take too long, even if it took a single day. Because actually when these kind of offenders, typically black males who were accused of raping white women, when they were charged in the official system, they were railroaded pretty fast, sentenced to death and hung in the courtyard the same day. The crowds wanted to impose medieval punishments.
Well, in this case, there were racial reasons. But have there been divine or religious aspects to the punishment?
So the death penalty... always,
we're talking about an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, aren't we?
The death penalty always echoes the Old Testament. And in fact, if you think about the central symbol of the Christian religion, the crucifix, there's an execution at the heart of the symbolism of that set of beliefs. But the thing about religion is that religious people have been both for and against the death penalty at every stage in its development. In fact, if you think about the way that the death penalty is argued about now, with the Constitution's chapter and verse being used for and against, 100 years ago it was the Bible that was being used for and against.
My guest is David Garland, Arthur T. Vanderbilt Professor of Law and Professor of Sociology at New York University. His book, Peculiar Institution, America's Death Penalty in an Age of Abolition, it is published by Harvard University Press. Okay, so public executions were eliminated and it was done more quietly. Why was that?
The basic reason wasn't that the public no longer wanted to see the death penalty imposed. It was that elites regarded it as being rather repugnant to see this violence and this uncomfortable behavior in public. They objected not just to the sight of the dead man dying, but also to the sight of the crowd enjoying it. But also officials, state officials who were carrying out the penalty, wanted to be more in control of what happened. One of the things about the death penalty is it's very fraught. It can easily go wrong. And the state officials like to ensure that they've got limited access to these problems.
We saw that in a number of cases with the electric chair where people weren't killed. But they always used to have a little theatrical event there, didn't they? There were always witnesses to the electric chair executions.
There still are witnesses, even with lethal injections today, if only to show that the public sentence of the court has been carried out appropriately. But what we've done is we've made the execution increasingly furtive and secret and behind the scenes.
Didn't the justification for the death penalty change from the will of the sovereign, the ruler, or whatever, to becoming a means of social welfare?
So over time, the death penalty has changed, first of all, from being a way in which states maintain themselves in government power to being a way in which the control of crime is enacted to eventually today, no one thinks that the death penalty is necessary to control crime. Now it's become more of a political and cultural symbol.
When did people start even arguing over this?
Well, the beginning of the real arguments about the death penalty occurred in the 18th century. Basically,
That long ago.
Basically, the Enlightenment thinkers criticized the old absolutist power regime as being too bloodthirsty and too ready to use state violence. But that was the time as well when prisons began to be developed. And as soon as prisons were available to secure and punish offenders, the death penalty came to be seen as less necessary than previously.
But you also say that the moral attention of Americans is highly selective.
I think the moral attention of Americans is like the moral attention of all populations everywhere. We focus on things that we're concerned about and we ignore and deny other issues. For example, we attend to the death penalty and we debate and discuss that, and the Supreme Court spends endless hours writing and arguing about it. We tend to forget the 2.4 million people in jails and prisons who, in some respects, are more deserving of our attention.
In some cases, they've been given very long sentences for drug offenses and minor crimes.
I think one of the things that keeps the death penalty in existence in this country is that our courts are so given to using very lengthy sentences of imprisonment for all kinds of crimes that whenever a very heinous crime comes along, a crime like an aggravated murder, it seems like the only way of marking that heinousness is the death penalty.
Although a life sentence would be a lot more terrible punishment for many people.
Well, that's not the view of the people on death row who, by and large, argue their cases and litigate their cases and appeal their cases to try and move from being on death row awaiting execution to being in life imprisonment without parole. But it's true that some people on death row decide to give up their appeals and they really volunteer for execution. These are the individuals you're thinking of.
How many people are sentenced to the death penalty annually?
So that's really declined markedly over the last 10 years. But last year, there were 112 death sentences imposed.
And how many are likely to actually be executed?
The number, if you look at all the people sentenced in the modern period since the 1970s to the present, only 15% of all those sentenced to death have actually been executed so far. Most cases, the death sentence is imposed by a jury and is subsequently overturned by courts of appeal or the federal courts.
It's interesting that this is an avoidable death, but there are other avoidable deaths, the result of poverty, for example. People don't talk about that at all.
It's a remarkable thing that we spend so much time and energy and political resources, indeed financial resources, on death penalties when they affect so few people. Whereas, as you say, other issues that are life and death issues seem to pass us by without the same intensity of debate.
Do you think that Americans have a particular fascination with death? I know many people talk about the Mexican fascination with death, which goes back to pre-Columbian times. Mm-hmm. But what about this country? Because of our history, because of the taming of the West and perhaps even the horrors of the Civil War, right, that we have a different attitude toward death than, let's say, somebody growing up I won't say Germany, but in France.
Right. I don't know that there are major differences for these reasons. Death is fascinating, I think, for all cultures. It is the case, though, that the levels of violence and the levels of homicide in this country are markedly different from those of other Western settled nations. So, for example, even now, after homicide rates have been falling for the last 10 years, our rate of murder is still about six times as high as comparable European countries. And that's one of the things that I think enlivens the intensity of emotion about how to deal with murderers.
But we also have the whole issue of whether we can own weapons or not. There aren't that many countries that really allow for the unfettered ownership of weapons on the scale of the United States.
I think what you're pointing to is one of the things that's connected to the high levels of homicide in this country, and that in turn is connected to...
Well, is it a chicken and egg situation? Is it because we have the guns that we have the high homicides, or do we have the high homicides because we want the guns?
We have high homicides, and we have guns, and we have death penalties for all the same kind of reason. The reason has to do with the nature of the American state and the American government. When it was formed in the 18th century and subsequently, the national government was never so powerful and sovereign control was never so concentrated in this nation as it was in other European nations and other Western ones. As a consequence, the West, but also the population as a whole, was never pacified to the same degree. Violence was never controlled. And of course, in the slave states, violence was even devolved to private slave owners. And that's one of the things that's maintained high homicide rates, high concern with violence, and death penalties in this country.
You say that one needs to understand the death penalty as a social fact.
I think so. I think people regard it as being a punishment. We should think about it in crime and punishment terms. But actually, as a punishment, it barely exists. It exists 110 death sentences for 14,000 homicides last year. Mostly it exists in this nation as a question of political debate and cultural consumption.
And we'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the debate You say that the subject of capital punishment seems to compel repetitive restatements of arguments and counterarguments, and nobody ever seems to get past them. My guest is David Garland, who is Arthur T. Vanderbilt Professor of Law and Professor of Sociology at New York University. His book, Peculiar Institution, America's Death Penalty in an Age of Abolition, it's published by Harvard University Press. Stay with us. We're back with David Garland, Arthur T. Vanderbilt Professor of Law and Professor of Sociology at New York University. His book, Peculiar Institution, America's Death Penalty in an Age of Abolition, it is published by Harvard University Press. I'm sure listeners are picking up the fact that you are not an American-born. Sounds Scots to me.
I am indeed. I'm Scottish. We moved here about 13 years ago. I have a dual citizenship now.
And I remember when Britain eliminated the death penalty, there were many people who were outraged. The polls indicated that the public wanted to continue the death penalty. Hasn't happened here. Why?
So given the chance, I think the publics of most countries would prefer to have the death penalty, at least particularly after they're polled in the wake of heinous crimes and so on. The fact is that in every other Western nation where the death penalty has been abolished, it's been abolished by a government elites and the establishment, you might say, in the face of popular support for the death penalty. In other words, the liberalism of the elites has outdone the democracy of the majority.
And were there no public protests?
You know, the issue was regarded as important by small groups of people that made a major protest about it. But by and large, most people regarded the death penalty as being much less important to them than social and economic policies and jobs and so on. And since elections there take place once every 5 years and people vote for a party, the death penalty gets folded into these other issues.
On the other hand, you say 30 years after the British Parliament abolished capital punishment, opinion polls show that 76% of the British population support its reintroduction.
It's true, but remember, a public opinion poll asks a single question. Do you or do you not support the death penalty? People say yes, rather casually, rather easily, and typically they haven't thought through the issue in very great depth. One of the things I want to do with this book is to try and make the death penalty move from being an abstract debate, capital punishment, yes or no, to thinking clearly about, given the kind of system that exists in this country, given the way it has to work, given the Constitution, do you still believe the death penalty is a reasonable process to endorse?
Well, it was pretty much eliminated for how many years?
There were no executions for about 10 years between 67 and 77.
And then it was only a Supreme Court case that opened up that can of worms again, only some states reinstituted the death penalty.
Right.
And there was a lot of resistance.
What happened was that in 72, the Supreme Court found all the death penalties that then existed to be unconstitutional. They were regarded as arbitrary and maybe also a violation of the prohibition on cruel and unusual punishments. In the wake of that 1972 decision, 35 different states reintroduced new laws. And in 1976, the court examined these laws and found at least some of them to be constitutional, which is why the death penalty was reintroduced at that stage and slowly began to be executed.
And what was the difference? How had they changed?
Well, basically, the new statutes insisted on giving more guidance to juries that made their mind up about death or life. They instituted appeals, and they divided the trial into two phases, one about the guilt of the defendant and then one about the question whether he should be put to death or not.
One of the interesting arguments against the death penalty is that appeals can go on so long that they become so expensive that it's actually cheaper to just sentence somebody to life without parole.
Well, that's for sure. Last year, of the people who were executed, 52 people were executed last year. On average, they'd each spent 14 years on death row awaiting that. And of course, in the 14 years that they were waiting, most other cases of other people on death row were overturned because actually, as I mentioned before, most death sentences that are imposed by a jury are subsequently overturned by a later court.
Well, let's get back to the subject of a source of repetitive restatements of arguments and counterarguments. What are the arguments for and what are the arguments against? And why do people seem to be unable to convince the other side.
Right. So the standard arguments for and against are as follows, that basically the death penalty is retributive and appropriate. It's the deserved punishment. People can agree or disagree about this. It's really a matter of convention and intuition. It's argued that it's deterrent and controls crime. It's very hard to believe that that could be true given the way that we impose the death penalty so rarely after such a long delay. On the other hand, there are nations, for example, Singapore, that impose the death penalty as a mandatory punishment for an economic crime like drug trafficking. Conceivably, it might be deterrent there. Always depends on how it's used.
And now Uganda is talking about the death penalty for homosexual activity.
And you can bet your life that Uganda won't impose layers of due process and appeal and procedure.
So that actually what that probably will do is simply force a lot of people who can afford it anyway, homosexuals, to leave the country.
I think it will also transform the standing of Uganda in the public opinion of the world, which is one of the reasons that the USA has to now, I think, take seriously, is it worthwhile having the death penalty given what it signifies about the nation?
Well, what do people in the rest of the world think about the United States? Isn't it true that sometimes they won't extradite someone who might face the death penalty?
Well, all of the European Union members, and indeed all of the members of the Council of Europe, which is a much larger organization, are committed to abolition. And they're also committed to avoiding extraditing offenders back to, or suspects back to, nations that use the death penalty for the very fear that they'll be put to death, perhaps, by an authoritarian government. The USA is caught up in that process and is regarded by many around the world as being like China or like Saudi Arabia or like Somalia in being a death penalty nation.
Governor Ryan of Illinois eliminated the death penalty. What were his arguments?
Well, he actually imposed a moratorium and an amnesty on the death row inmates in Illinois because up until the point that he intervened, there had been more people on the Illinois death row who'd been exonerated, that's to say found innocent of their crime, than had actually been executed. And that actually points up one of the important things about the death penalty in this country. There are 35 states have the death penalty, but actually only about 11 or 12 of them actually use it. And these are mostly southern states.
And Texas is one of the prime examples. And there have been a number of cases recently where it looks like somebody might have been executed who was innocent of the crime. But it hasn't seemed to stop anybody in Texas from trying to impose the death penalty in other cases.
You know, it's true that there's an enormous will to impose and to execute death sentences in that state. But even there,
do you know why?
Well, first of all, it's a very high homicide state. It's a state in the South too, where the death penalty, for reasons that are interesting and historical, to do with the 1960s and 1970s politics, the death penalty came to be associated with a certain kind of civil rights politics. And the same forces that overturned segregation and overturned Jim Crow were assumed to be the ones that wanted to abolish the death penalty. So there's a certain kind of Southern traditionalism and a certain Southern conservatism which connects the death penalty with a way of life and a Southern identity. I think you see that very singularly in Texas.
Although Texas was not a real Deep South state.
It wasn't a Deep South state, but it's also a state that responds very badly to being told what to do from the outside. The notion that federal government and that the federal Supreme Court could take away the Texans' death penalty was regarded as being an outrage by many people there.
You say that most writers feel compelled to engage with the institution in their books. Do you mean that they feel compelled to challenge it or promote their own view of it?
Well, the vast majority of writing about the death penalty is actually writing against the death penalty, I would say. That's definitely true in law schools, but it's also true in literature. It's also true in art. One reason for that, of course, is that the death penalty is established, and so there's less need to write about it in order to support it. But I think that you might say that modern, liberal, humane, civilized culture, which is the background assumptions of much art and much literature, is firmly against the death penalty, and you see that in the kind of writing that appears.
You say that capital punishment in America is a story of a legal norm combined with widespread evasion. Evasion in what way?
Right. What I mean by that is that the 35 states have the death penalty on their books, but many of them never impose any sentences, or if they impose any sentences, never carry out any executions. For example, New Jersey in 2007 abolished their death penalty for the simple reason that they'd had it for 30-odd years and never used it.
We do have a death penalty in New York State, and every so often a capital case will come up and they'll ask whether the death penalty will be requested, and it never seems to be.
Well, what happened?
So is there some kind of collusion between district's attorney?
This is exactly the having the norm and violating the norm that I have in mind. In 1995, there was a Capital Punishment Act passed in this state. Most insiders knew at the time it would never lead to the execution of anyone. 10 years later, the highest court in the state, the Court of Appeals, actually found it to be invalid. And there have been no efforts since then to impose a new death penalty. So, in fact, New York State technically does not really have the death penalty any longer. Even if it had it, it wouldn't use it.
My guest is David Garland, a professor of law and sociology at NYU. His latest book is Peculiar Institution, published by Harvard Press. And what do you mean by peculiar institution? Why is the American death penalty different than the death penalty that's imposed in China or Singapore or any of a number of other countries?
So the death penalty in America is peculiar. No other nation imposes the death penalty so rarely and then so hesitatingly and then reverses and undoes most of the sentences of the court. But the peculiar institution title, as I'm sure you know and many of the listeners know, refers also to the institution of slavery and southern slavery in the antebellum South. Because one of the things that the book argues is that the history of the death penalty in this country has been the history of courts trying to counter and struggle against the legacy of racial violence and lynching, and for many of the southern counties where the death penalty is still very popular, to mobilize the same kind of forces that once upon a time produced lynching.
Well, the studies indicate, as you said earlier, that death penalty doesn't really have a deterrent effect. If I am suddenly outraged for one reason or another, or I am a sociopath, I'm not thinking about whether somewhere down the line I'm going to get they're going to inject me with lethal drugs. So if it isn't a deterrent, then really it is just simply a matter of vengeance. Aren't people made uncomfortable by that?
Well, vengeance is the eyes of the beholder. Other people see the same thing as being appropriate moral retribution.
But as you point out, it is also applied unequally.
That's much more difficult to argue. I think it's possible to put forward a morally serious argument in favor of retribution for the appropriately serious crimes. It's very hard to argue in this country that retribution is delivered in a fair way, or indeed that retribution is even carried out effectively. After all, if you care about retribution, you certainly don't want your murderer to wait 14 years before being executed and perhaps during that time become some kind of hero to the death penalty defense bar.
Why did the momentum that led to the abolishment of the death penalty throughout the rest of the Western world not have any impact on the United States?
So, well, first of all, it did have an impact. Most of the states in this country, 25 states at one time or another, have abolished the death penalty. 10 of them reenacted it.
Some very early. Michigan in the 19th century?
Michigan in 1846 and Wisconsin and Rhode Island a little time later. So there were American death penalty abolitions occurring long before the finger-wagging, sanctimonious Europeans began to get around to it. One of the things that we should bear in mind is that France was still decapitating people in 1977, long after all such practices had ended in this country.
With the guillotine.
But the reason in the end why the American nation has not abolished the death penalty in the same nationwide way that other European and Western countries have is that that power simply isn't available to the U.S. Congress. Our Constitution allocates the power to punish to the 50 states. To have the death penalty disappear across the whole nation here, you have to have 50 separate abolitions.
So it would really be up to the Supreme Court to change things.
Right.
And the Supreme Court has waffled on this.
The Supreme Court has indeed waffled. It's one of the areas of jurisprudence which is the most volatile and the most confused of all legal areas. I would say that the Supreme Court that currently exists will not consider abolishing the death penalty. However, I could imagine 10 or 15 years from now, more states doing what New Jersey and New Mexico did, which is to say, get rid of a death sentence they don't actually use, and the death penalty would become confined to those 10 or 12 southern states that still actually execute it. At that stage, the Supreme Court might revisit the issue and regard it as being cruel and unusual.
Because, and one of the reasons New Jersey dropped it is because it will save it a lot of money?
Every death penalty case that's prosecuted, every capital case that's prosecuted, is enormously expensive compared to a regular murder case.
We're talking about American exceptionalism in terms of our history. Does that also work in Europe, where people live through Hitler and Stalin?
You know, one of the reasons that the death penalty was abolished in many countries around the world was to draw a line at the end of authoritarian regimes. Writing a new liberal constitution after the war, the Germans, the Austrians, the Italians, all of them abolished the death penalty. They never again wanted to allow a government to have the power to kill its citizens.
But you also say that at the end of the 20th century, when most Western nations abolished capital punishment, America reinvented it.
This was the strange and, I think, quite contingent story of how the civil rights movement had prompted the Supreme Court to look at the death penalty as an issue of civil rights and to try and abolish it. In 1972, the court actually did so. But then the pushback came from 35 states. And remember, the early 1970s was a period of emerging concern about law and order, high crime rates, riots in the streets and so on, and indeed a backlash against civil rights. At that point, the death penalty is reinvented in this country, and it's persisted ever since.
And it becomes a political issue as well, like the Willie Horton ads.
There's no doubt that the death penalty is life in this country in the last 30 years, had been primarily the life of a political issue, used by politicians to embarrass their opponents, who might be seen as soft on crime. And then eventually, when even their opponents, like the Democrats, came round to supporting it too, outbidding each other in terms of how many capital offenses they can introduce.
So here we are with any number of people executed each year. Has anybody looked into what purpose the death penalty serves just by looking at the individual cases?
Well, the argument that proponents make is that the death penalty doesn't serve deterrence very likely, but it may well indeed serve to be the appropriate punishment for serious crimes. And at the moment when a jury imposes that sentence, that's a plausible claim. But if you look at what happens thereafter, that appropriate retribution is then diluted over decades. And if the family or the community had hoped for swift retributive justice, they're going to be denied it. The Constitution won't allow.
David Garland is Arthur T. Vanderbilt Professor of Law and Professor of Sociology at New York University. His latest book is called Peculiar Institution, America's Death Penalty in an Age of Abolition, and it is published by Harvard University Press. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.